This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is a Thinking Aloud podcast from the BBC. And for more details and much, much more about Thinking Aloud, go to our website at bbc.co.uk. Now, although there have been millions of words written about the Trump phenomenon, I was enormously pleased to come across a book that saw Trump's ascendancy and behaviour in office as part of a new emerging pattern of authoritarian leadership. That book is entitled Strong Men, How They Rise, Why They Succeed and How They Fall. And the author of Strong Men, Ruth Ben-Ghiert, who's Professor of History and Italian Studies at New York University, ranges across recent history for her examples of how such authoritarian rule degrades or destroys democracy. Not just Trump, but from Mussolini to Hitler, Gaddafi to Pinochet, Berlusconi to Erdogan, and on, yes, on to Putin. Well, Ruth Ben-Ghiert now joins me. Ruth, you argue that we're living in an age of political rulers or strong men who draw on an authoritarian playbook. Now, how would you characterise their agenda? What are its main features?
The main agenda of authoritarians is to amass and retain as much personal power as possible. And to that end, they use a playbook which hasn't really evolved that much over the ages in some ways. The tools of rule are corruption, violence, the myth of national greatness, and propaganda, and also machismo, which is what makes the strongmen, virility and machismo, as a way that these male leaders seek and keep their political legitimacy.
Give me some examples of this trait.
When we see Putin, the Russian president, posing with his shirt off and taking ice baths, it's really easy to just laugh that off. But I argue in my book that it's deadly serious because it connects to these other tools where you have this kind of brutal model of leadership and manhood that fosters imitators throughout the system. It also supports corruption because the authoritarian is the man who gets away with what other people cannot.
You also cite Gaddafi's sex dungeons, Mobutu's sexual conquest of the wives of his officials, and also Mussolini's deployment of the Italian secret police to procure women for him. What is the effect of this particular aspect of this authoritarian rule?
The personal sex life of the strongman, as in those cases you cited, it matters because when you have this model of power, which is all-encompassing and devoid of any respect for the divide between public and private, or, you know, state resources and personal use of them, all of the apparatus of the state gets kind of hijacked and rerouted to serving the strongman's personal needs. And that could be thievery. Putin has amassed a kleptocracy. That could be a sex addiction, or just wars and imperialist conquests taken out of obsessions with their place in history and hubris.
The list of people you cite, Benito Mussolini, Hitler, Francisco Franco, Augusto Pinochet, Silvio Berlusconi, Vladimir Putin, Viktor Orban and Donald Trump, all figures on the political right, but you don't seem to pay attention to communist authoritarians such as, well, Mao and Stalin. Well, why not?
The left has produced strong men who are equally murderous, but I'm a historian of fascism originally, and I really wanted to show this trajectory for over 100 years of what happens when, you know, fascism goes away. The tools of rule and the ideologies, they remain, and they go into Cold War dictators such as Pinochet in Chile in the 1970s and 80s, which I cover, and on up to leaders who are new authoritarians, and that they come to power via elections and they don't totally destroy democracy, like Bolsonaro in Brazil, who is openly inspired by Pinochet and has said things like, oh, Pinochet didn't actually kill enough people. So these ideologies of the right and the tactics of fascism are still very much in our world today and inspiring people like Donald Trump in America, former president. And that is why that's the trajectory I chose to trace in the book.
But, I mean, how realistic is it to compare fascist dictators we've been talking about, such as Mussolini and Hitler, to a US president who was, after all, elected in 2016 and then voted out of office in 2020? I mean, that's democracy at work. Isn't democracy by definition somehow inconsistent with authoritarian rule?
That's an excellent question. And I'm a historian, and the idea is to show the evolution of authoritarianism. And although, yes, you still have today places like North Korea and China where you have one-party states and, you know, no opposition media, today the formula is different. And so you have leaders who come in through elections, and then they have to arrange the electoral system so it produces the results they need to stay in power. As in Hungary, you don't get rid of the opposition. You just domesticate the media, make it very difficult for the opposition to win. And so the idea of the book is to see what has changed and what has stayed the same, so that you have Donald Trump or Bolsonaro or Orban, they very much echo the themes of fascism and some of the tactics, but one-party states are less common today.
So you're talking really about the durability of strongmen, aren't you? Once they're in office, everything Trump has done has come straight from the authoritarian playbook. Expand on that for me.
It's quite extraordinary what he accomplished, because he did not, you know, succeed in wrecking democracy. He did not close down the media environment, and yet he created a personality cult and a bond so durable that millions of people, tens of millions of people in America today still think he won the election.
And you cite the riot on the Capitol, the number of Republican officials who took part in that.
One of the most tragic things from the point of view of democracy is the evolution of the Republican Party into what I consider a far-right party with an authoritarian political culture. And what this means is that Trump made the GOP into his personal tool, and not only legitimized the use of threat and violence, as we saw on January 6th, but a true departure from any respect for the norms of democracy, and also tolerance for others' ideas. And in fact, in the party today, there is a party line about January 6th, and you are not allowed, even as a Republican politician, to cross that line. And in February 2021, there was the second impeachment trial of Trump, and Republican politicians who voted to impeach Trump, so they voted out of their party, they had to seek refuge and buy body armor because they were being threatened. You know, they had death threats. So this is an authoritarian political culture.
Because you say that racial politics and the protection of the white Christian heritage, that's one of the master narratives which are fueling this authoritarian right. Can you expand on that?
I saw an incredible similarity between the rhetoric used by Mussolini, who was the first in the 1920s, he developed this project of kind of white racial rescue. And he worried about people of color having too many babies and white people not having enough. So there's a direct echo of that in the things that Viktor Orban says, or Vladimir Putin, or the American right today, people like Tucker Carlson. And so one of the patterns I discern in the book is that these kinds of leaders have an appeal when a country has gone through a lot of demographic or social change. It could be racial equity, it could be changing composition of the population. And this is lauded by many as progress, and others feel it's a kind of existential threat. And so these leaders cater to that, and they say, I'm going to fix it. I'm going to, you know, expel immigrants and restore white honor and celebrate, you know, traditional privileges. And that sells for 100 years. And it was really fascinating to go back to the origins of that. Hitler is much more known for obvious reasons, but Mussolini had a complete project of battle for babies, of increasing the white birth rate in ways that we hear about today, and this kind of stoking fears of being replaced by others, non-whites who are more prolific, more fertile. These are very primal fears that have proven effective over 100 years.
America has experienced in recent times a threat to democracy, but you point out this is hardly a new experience for many other countries, including ones where dictatorships and strongmen have actually been enabled by US foreign policy. Give me some examples.
Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet, the Chilean coup of 1973, which was backed and partly made possible by the United States as part of its Cold War policy of, you know, defeating Marxism and enabling local leaders who would do that for them. And what's extraordinary is that this playbook of kind of defeating Marxist insurgency has kind of come home to the United States. And that was one of the things that the Trump era saw, where you had a kind of construction of the left as a present threat to American society as part of the propaganda point. This has been very effective in polarizing Americans, and it's quite common for supporters of Trump to think that Biden is a socialist dictator. And so there is this playbook that goes directly back to Chile to try and unseat a democratically elected head of state by claiming that he is out to create, you know, a communist dictatorship.
Really, we should pay particular attention at this moment in time to Vladimir Putin, shouldn't we? I mean, you were writing before Russia invaded Ukraine on the 24th of February. So tell me how Putin fits into your thesis, and perhaps more particularly the ways in which it might shed light on his behavior right now.
When you've been in power for a long time, you've had too much power for too long. These kinds of leaders, they become very isolated. They become more paranoid. They think they have all the answers. They don't listen to experts. And I really think that Putin had intimations of his power being at his peak. Especially among young people, there's a lot of disaffection in Russia. And he's had to game the system, putting any kind of real contender like Alexei Navalny in prison. And so he embarked on this reckless invasion of Ukraine. And there's even a term for this called gambling for resurrection. When dictators feel that perhaps things are going to slip away from them, they do something grand to secure their place in history. And yet they don't plan it out properly. They miscalculate. So just as Mussolini, you know, rushed into World War II on Hitler's side against the advice of all of his generals, we now know that Putin did not game out this invasion with his military. He consulted with very few people. The decision-making circle was tiny. And so he miscalculated in ways that are shocking to many people, but not if you know the logic of dictators.
So Putin is vulnerable?
If the war continues and the Russian losses mount up, I can only imagine the disaffection in the Russian military after losing seven generals. Elites have supported Putin because he brought prestige of Russia in the world. Now that lies in shambles. And Putin never expected this global economic warfare and sanctions against him. If it drags on and the losses mount up, he will, I believe, be vulnerable, as has happened to other authoritarians in the past.
Now, I've described your book as encyclopedic, but it does exclude strong women political leaders. Weren't there any that fitted the bill?
I looked at people who wrecked a democracy. And while we've had leaders whose personalities fit certain aspects of that, Indira Gandhi or Margaret Thatcher, but they certainly didn't wreck democracy. That wasn't their aim. I do say that the prominence of women like Marine Le Pen in the new right, especially in Europe, but also in America, means that it is inevitable that we'll have a female-led authoritarian state. And so you could see the book in a way as a snapshot of a certain configuration of power, kind of male corrosive power that has endured over a century, but will eventually mutate. And as we see with the upcoming French elections, and Marine Le Pen could be the first example of that.
We've talked about Putin's possible vulnerability. What are the ways in which strong men have been defeated, ways in which they actually have lost power?
So if there is still an opposition, it's very important for opposition to band together. That doesn't always work. It didn't work in Hungary in the recent elections. But in other times, like Chile, they managed to vote Pinochet out, and they had a massive coalition that registered millions of voters who'd been struck from the rolls. And that's an example of a successful grassroots movement and elite unity conspiring to get rid of a dictator. It also helped that the Americans withdrew their support. Other times they kind of do themselves in the case of Mobutu, who stole so much and plunged Zaire into such a state of abject poverty that eventually he was forced into exile. And the psychological rule is that they are the last ones to realize that they are hated by their people and that their power has eroded.
And of course, you place great stress on the importance of taking vigorous action against corruption as one of the ways in which these leaders can be undermined. In many ways, the failure to pass anti-corruption reform leaves the way open for them to regain power or to hold on to power.
In the old days, it was easier because they just put their money in Swiss bank accounts. And so you only had one source, the Swiss. Now, 21st century is a whole other system, which is now the spotlight's been placed on it because of the sanctions against Putin and the oligarchs. And that is that they funnel their money into offshore finance networks, which are supported by the US, by England, and by other Western powers. It's wealth managers, international law firms, a whole gamut of enablers who are now having the spotlight shown on them. And I'm hoping that this experience of seeing the ravages of Ukraine by Putin will lead to a new culture of anti-corruption around the world.
Ruth, those strike me as excellent final words. Thank you very much. And of course, I'd welcome any other comments on Ruth's analysis, and you'll find me at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. Every house will be saffron. The rule of Rama will come. Well, those are the lyrics of a song by Lakshmi Dubé, a star in what's come to be known as the saffron pop scene, the soundtrack to a set of policies that are seeking to transform the secular and pluralistic nation of India into more and more of a Hindu state. Well, to help me understand this upsurge in Hindu nationalism, I'm joined by Christoph Jaffrello, who's Professor of Indian Politics and Sociology at King's College London. You've listened, I think, to Ruth's interview. I wonder whether you see Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who began his second term of office in 2019, as fitting into her pantheon of strong men leaders and authoritarian rule.
There are many reasons why Narendra Modi fits in this list of strong men. But a very important distinction, to my mind, needs to be made between the authoritarian rulers who can lose elections and the others. Mussolini, Hitler, Gaddafi, Mobutu could not lose elections. And Putin cannot lose elections either today. By contrast, Erdogan, Modi, Bolsonaro may lose elections, and we may wonder why. Why do they take the risk of organizing such elections? And the obvious reason is sometimes they can't avoid doing so because there are still checks and balances. But there is, to my mind, another reason. They have become strong men through an electoral process as the voice of the people in the name of democracy. For me, we see today the making of a new political regime, a regime that is certainly authoritarian, but in which the leader needs to take the risk of some election. Of course, he will try not to lose by distorting the electoral process. So politics is not a level playing field anymore because of the money they spend, because of corruption, because of the biased media. But still, there is some competition, and therefore we have a populist regime, because this is what the populist does. He gets the mandate from the people.
Let me ask you a little about Modi's route to power, how he has used Hindu nationalism in his route to power.
He is a pure product of the Hindu nationalist movement, the RSS, that he has joined as a child when he was 7 years old. And he has become a cadre of this organization is in Om state, Gujarat, in western India. It's only in 2001 that he has been parachuted head of the government of Gujarat even though he had never been elected before. His party, the BJP, was losing all the by-elections. And in less than 6 months after becoming head of the state government, the state of Gujarat has been devastated by Hindu-Muslim violence that resulted in the death of 2,000 Muslims. And Modi could appear as a strong man at that time.
He's in a way portraying Muslims in the States as a sort of fifth column for Pakistan, as I understand
it. Of course.
He says, I'm the only person who can protect residents from terrorist threats from Pakistan.
And that is the first achievement he could claim, saying, I'm protecting the Hindus from Muslims, from Islamists, from Pakistan. And there was a war in 65 between Pakistan and India in Gujarat, and people remember. So that's in his rise to power, in his route to power, a major episode. Then, soon after, he befriended businessmen who have always been very influential in Gujarat. He gave them special economic zones and they gave him money to contest elections. And this, I would say, alchemy between, on the one hand, Hindu majoritarianism and, on the other hand, economic dynamism were the two ingredients of his 2014 campaign when he contested for the post of prime minister and was elected for the first time prime minister of India.
So this is a sort of new form of democracy which considers the majoritarian community synonymous with the nation. So Muslims, Christians get turned into second class citizens.
Yes, this is why we can apply the concept of ethnic democracy to India today. Of course, there are elections, some rule of law, but there is also a majority community that is defined by religion / language, and this majority prevails over the minorities who do not enjoy the same rights. India is a de facto ethnic democracy because on the paper, in the constitution, secularism remains the law, but de facto Muslims and Christians will find difficult to find a flat in a mixed neighborhood. They will find it difficult to marry a Hindu. And these groups also try to reconvert Muslims and Christians. We are transitioning in India from a de facto ethnic democracy to a de jure one, because for long there was no law making it so difficult for Hindus and Muslims to marry. Now there are laws, and not only in Uttar Pradesh, the largest state of India that is ruled by the BJP, but in others now, several states have adopted the same law. It's against what they call love jihad, because in fact, they suspect Muslim boys to seduce Hindu girls, to marry them, to convert them, and to produce Muslim babies. So this is something we saw also in the West with this idea that demography is a problem. Muslims are proliferating. But I repeat, what is very interesting in this case is that it's not de facto only. It is the law that is changing. And that is something we saw also in 2019 when the government introduced the Citizenship Amendment Act, because that law was in fact making the Muslim refugees from Bangladesh, Afghanistan, and Pakistan not eligible to Indian citizenship. So for the first time, religion became a criterion for citizenship just after the re-election of Narendra Modi.
Well, I've got a clip here. This is from a BBC News report of the Delhi riots on February the 27th, 2020.
Fear. As tensions remain high in Delhi, the national capital, a battleground. Violent clashes between Hindus and Muslims have rocked the city for days. Entire neighbourhoods ripped apart as mobs roam the streets. The riots have been centred in the northeast of the city, in largely Muslim neighbourhoods.
Now, over 50 people, I understand, were killed in those riots, two-thirds of whom were Muslim. And I should say that that Modi did condemn that violence. But let me ask you about the extent to which you think that Modi has undermined democracy during his rule.
Power is centralised in the hands of very few men, at the expense of the party, the BJP, at the expense of parliament, and at the expense of federalism. India is a union of states, according to the Constitution of India. But the state governments have not been consulted. For instance, before Modi took the major decision of imposing a lockdown in 2020. There was no consultation. Power is not only personalized, it's also concentrated. Secondly, the opposition and the media have been victims of all kinds of intimidation, including raids by the fiscal administration, or in the case of journalists, arrests for sedition under very stringent laws like the National Security Act. That's another clearly authoritarian transformation. And on the top of it, of course, the resources on the side of the ruling party makes very difficult for the opposition to compete. In 2019, BJP spent $3.6 billion to win the elections. Nobody could compete with these kind of expenditures.
To what extent does Modi fit this pattern of the authoritarian leader?
If you look at the personality of Narendra Modi, you will find affinities with some of these authoritarian personalities in the sense that he doesn't accept dissent. You have this cult of personality that is very, very deep rooted now in BJP. And that goes, by the way, with a form of narcissism that is very evident from the way he dresses, the way he speaks, especially when he speaks in public, of course. Last but not least, this idea that you are bound to change history, which means that you do big things, good or bad. This is also one of the characteristics of a strong man.
Because when I was speaking to Ruth about whether or not you could describe a leader as authoritarian, if this person had been chosen by the electorate, I mean, isn't Modi backed by popular consent?
Democracy is not only based on elections. The other is rule of law, independence of the judiciary, checks and balances.
What are the chances, as you see it in the current climate, for a revival of India's once much more inclusive democracy?
The strength of Hindu majoritarianism is such that for the moment, any alternative seems to be illegitimate, at least at the national level. To return to a more inclusive democracy, as you say, you have to replace the dominant identity politics of Hindu nationalism by socioeconomic issues. There may be a lot of discontent because of joblessness, because of growing inequalities. The risk of a popular movement is very high. Indian democracy may be rejuvenated.
And there I think we must stop. Christoph Jaffrelot, thank you very much. And thank you for listening. Thinking Aloud is produced in partnership with the Open University. Next week's topic, footwear, the magic and the material reality. Do join me for that. That was a Thinking Aloud podcast from BBC Radio 4. You'll find a treasure trove of other Thinking Aloud programmes on BBC Sounds.